Next case for argument is Brown versus Baldwin. Mr. Stern?
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent the appellant in this case, and I believe that the primary issue in this case is whether or not there were competing facts and inferences making the granting of summary judgment improper. In this particular case, as the court will recall, it involved a handing out of various materials at the Milwaukee Courthouse on Jury Rights Day in September 5th, 2000. And there is a completely different...
Well, I tell you, what I find particularly troublesome about the case, I can't believe there's a constitutional right in a courthouse to advocate jury nullification. So you have the jurors coming in, and they're being told they should deliberate improperly. They should disregard the judge. I don't get that.
I don't think that it is contrary whatsoever to distribute pamphlets that they were doing.
You're going to defend that, allowing people to urge jurors to nullify the law?
I would defend passing out
in the courthouse.
Yes,
in the courthouse.
Yes. In this country?
It really subverts the justice system.
Maybe it does, but...
Maybe it does, but and it's constitutional.
But the First Amendment allows people to communicate. Not with jurors.
The First Amendment, in many cases on this, the First Amendment is understood to require a balance between free speech and the right to a fair trial. Well, isn't that balance disturbed when you have someone in a courthouse who is urging jurors to disobey the judge's instructions?
Well, first of all, the jurors come in at 8 o'clock. They were there at 9 o'clock. And distributing that pamphlet to...
Well, suppose they've been there at 8 o'clock. Would you make the same argument for First Amendment privilege?
Yes.
You would?
Yes.
Can they go into the jury room and when the jurors are deliberating and hand out a pamphlet saying you should disregard the judge's instructions?
No.
That's jury tampering.
Yes.
Why is it jury tampering if on their way into the courtroom you... urge them to disobey the judge's instructions?
Well, in the history of this case, which goes back to 1991, they had worked out a time for the people to come into the courthouse on jury rights day so that it wouldn't, they would not pass out the pamphlets to the jurors and there wouldn't be the risk of jury tampering, and therefore they were distributing the information to just citizens walking in and out of that courthouse.
As a throwaway line, who dreamed up the idea of Jury Rights Day?
Governor Thompson.
What was the impetus for this? I mean, jurors were being pushed around in Wisconsin on a regular basis. I bow to my colleague on the far left, but I mean, is that what was happening? Jurors were being shoved around and mishandled and...
No, I don't know their rights. It was, as I recall, and I'm kind of guessing a little, is that Governor Thompson wanted to honor jurors and wanted that day set aside to honor the jury system and to honor that process.
Couldn't you say jury honoring day as opposed to...
I guess.
The jurors have no right, as a matter of law, to know to ignore what the judge tells them.
I'm not saying they do. What I'm saying is that through the years, 1991 to 2000, when this happened, there had been worked out. There was much problem with this group of people who were handing out these pamphlets.
Yeah.
And they had worked out a system that they would come in at a certain time and situate themselves at a certain place.
Who worked out this deal?
Judge Sheedy, the chief judge, eventually set aside a judicial order that had prevented this type of communication in 1995.
Sounds like a sensible order to me.
But my problem, I think, is shared by my brothers, but is there a constitutional right to inform prospective jurors that they can ignore their oaths as jurors to follow the law as given by the judge?
If you went into the jury room, right into the jury outside that room, no.
They're sworn in before they have to worry about that. If they're just prospective jurors, you can do it.
There's a marketplace of ideas. That's what the First Amendment is to protect.
I don't think that jurors should have to do this, and it seems to me they shouldn't have to do this, you could say. But to say that you can ignore, you have a right, a jury has a right to ignore the instruction of the court, especially if being allowed.
The group was advocating what we call jury nullification.
That's it, which is to ignore the instruction of the court.
They were not communicating directly to jurors. And I think that's the difference.
But you said it's all right for them to communicate to prospective jurors.
Well, we don't know who they are.
No, you're saying it's all right. They can come in at 8 a.m.
Because they come in at a certain time.
Yeah, but you say it's okay for these, your client and his whistleblower friend, courier, whatever his name is, to come in at 8 a.m., you know, as the jurors are filing in, and hand each of them a pamphlet saying disobey the judge's instructions. That's to me ridiculous.
That's why
the First Amendment means.
That's why they worked out 9 o'clock. And that's why the jurors were already...
But you say that you really do have a constitutional right to be there at 8 o'clock.
Well, I think you don't know who's going to come in and out. I think we've got to give jurors credit that they're going to be able to... whatever happened outside of the courthouse or two blocks away. What's the difference? It's in a public place. They have a right to be in a public place.
Owen
versus California indicates that. And even the Courier case in 1990 indicates that that had the person not been actually in a courtroom and having bumped into someone in the courtroom causing a disturbance, creating a disturbance, that person, the plaintiff in that case, would have every right to have distributed what he wanted at that time and at that place. You look at basically time, place, and circumstances. That's what the First Amendment talks about. And a ruling that ignores that, which in this case was the ruling of the trial court in this case, is a trial court that essentially allows the police officers to snuff out First Amendment freedoms.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schneider. Mr. Jorgensen?
Before you take off in the walk, do I understand that Wisconsin permits this sort of thing as a matter of law?
Well, I can't really speak for the whole state of Wisconsin. I guess I should first identify myself.
I already had you figured out.
Okay. I represent the defendant's appellees in this case. Apparently, in this court's view, Milwaukee County anyway, and I can't really speak for the whole state of Wisconsin, has erred on the side of liberality, in that we do permit these gentlemen to come to the courthouse every year on
September. So that's not an issue in this case.
Maybe we should talk about who we're talking about. In the second row there, the gentleman on the
Well,
I think the
really awful is not material to anything I can think of. All I want to know is what the beef is, what Wisconsin does relative to these people.
Mr. Brown was cited and given a brief timeout over in the CJF next to the... He was arrested, yes, and cited for disorderly conduct because his conduct was, in fact, disorderly. Mr. Currier, the other gentleman back there sitting next to Mr. Brown, was the gentleman who was standing in the middle of the hallway in the rotunda of the courthouse, dressed as a judge in a black robe, with a sign saying, "Why do judges hide the truth?" And he was permitted to do this undisturbed. So I really think that there's no
judge hiding the truth.
Anyway, in terms of the First Amendment, I think what
did he say was disorderly?
These gentlemen were approached by deputies on a couple of occasions based on complaints from citizenry or people working in courthouse offices that there was some kind of disturbance.
why did the officer do? Tell him to move on?
Well,
and they
the first time, the deputy, a deputy who's not a defendant in this action came up and said, you know, I think you guys are going to have to move along. And Mr. Currier said, no, this is all settled. You better call your sergeant. We have the perfect right to remain here as long as we do so peaceably. And she did call her sergeant, and she was so advised, and that was the end. Then there was another complaint, and then a number of other deputies, including Deputy Frank Koliak, who is one of the defendants in this matter, reported to the scene. They saw Mr. Currier there in the row with the sign and the pamphlets and did not disturb him because it was well settled by this point. We were tired of being sued by these people. We are acknowledging their right to do this. Apart from Mr. Currier, stood Mr. Brown with his camera.
Reaction to lawsuits. Someone brings a frivolous suit, so you cave.
Well,
you don't want to have another frivolous suit brought against you.
I guess I...
I can't really say that. A person is allowed to go into a courthouse and impersonate a judge?
Well, I don't think anybody actually thought that Mr. Currier was a judge.
Well, if you were a witness and you came in, say you're a witness, you've come to the courthouse for the first time, you see this fellow standing there wearing a judge's robe, well, why would you not think he was a judge?
I honestly, because the whole thing is so preposterous, I guess is my only response, Your Honor. The problem is, though, that Mr. Brown, who's the plaintiff in this matter, was not the person who was exercising his First Amendment rights, perhaps beyond the bounds that this court would have allowed. He was standing apart, taking pictures. And when he was approached by Deputy Frank Koliak, who asked him what his business was, he protested loudly, saying, I'm not going to tell you anything.
But his conduct was... fact, though, whether he protested loudly or quietly?
Well, I don't think that a factual dispute in this context matters. The question.
But if you're just standing there taking pictures, why is that disorderly conduct?
That wasn't disorderly conduct. The disorderly conduct consisted of his reaction and responses.
Well, is that undisputed or is that disputed? What is reaction?
Well, there's a couple causes of action here, and maybe we should disaggregate them. I mean, one is the First Amendment claim, and the county's position or the defendant's position is that no one was motivated by any intention to squelch anybody's First Amendment rights. If that were the case, somebody would have arrested Mr. Currier, the man with the robe and the sign. Also, somebody would have arrested Mr. Brown again when he came back 20 minutes later and resumed his position in the courthouse, continued this activity until he left of his own volition. And then he came back the next year. There's also a claim here for false arrest, and I think that would require proof that there was no probable cause to issue this disorderly conduct citation. And that isn't defeated by the fact that there are perhaps competing versions of the fact. There would be probable cause sufficient to justify
the version of the fact. Is it just that he's standing there taking pictures quietly and... is that it?
Oh, no. No, I don't think he ever said he was being quiet. I think he acknowledged that he protested what he viewed as an unwarranted interference with his activities. The issue was, I think, based on the testimony of all the participants whose deposition testimony appears in the record, that there was at least probable cause to believe that Mr. Brown was, in fact, being disorderly, that he was violating the disorderly conduct ordinance. There was proof at least to show that guilt of violation was more than a mere possibility. I don't think that the existence of probable cause for purposes of justifying this arrest and defeating a claim of wrongful
arrest.
What
exactly was he doing that was disorderly, according to the uncontroverted facts?
When approached and asked what his business was, instead of responding to what the deputy was asking him to do, he protested that he didn't have to tell the deputy anything, that he was not going to tell the deputy anything, and that he was going to sue the deputy, which he did in fact do. And the deputy asked him to step aside from the crowd that was gathering, and another deputy did testify that people were disturbed by this disturbance. He refused to do so, whereupon Deputy Frank Koliak escorted him to the adjoining criminal justice facility where he wrote him a disorderly conduct citation and sent him on his way. And his way, by the way, was right back to the courthouse to continue with whatever it is that these folks were doing.
Now, was he ordered not to return to the courthouse?
No. Obviously not. He did. And
I didn't
say
no.
No, he was not. He was simply shown the door.
No.
Yeah. Out onto 10th Street, and he went back down 10th Street and in the door.
He right back in again.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe the uncontroverted evidence establishes that there was at least probable cause to believe that he was cited, not because of his involvement with Mr. Currier's protected First Amendment activity, about which this court is, I guess, somewhat dubious, but because his conduct was, in fact, disorderly, and that the deputy's response, which was to issue him a disorderly conduct citation and set him down for a few minutes while he wrote that citation and then show him the door, was not unreasonable under the circumstances. That there was proof at least sufficient to show that the guilt of the violation of disorderly conduct was more than a mere possibility, regardless of some dispute as to who said what when. And I don't think there's any dispute that Mr. Brown said that he wasn't going to do or wasn't going to answer Deputy Frank Koliak's question, that his response was that he was going to sue Deputy Frank Koliak.
Did he refuse to identify himself?
I don't know that the record discloses whether he was asked for identification. I think the record suggests that Deputy Frank Koliak knew who Mr. Brown was, or it came to him who Mr. Brown was because of
his historical involvement. What do you contend he actually refused to do?
Step aside and talk to Deputy Frank Koliak about what his business was there.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jorgensen. Mr. Stern, how much time do you have? 2 minutes?
Your Honor, that's the Fourth Amendment issue is in dispute. The plaintiff denies that he ever indicated that he was going to talk with the officer. The officer says that's what he said. So there you have two different facts of the situation.
That would be interesting if we're questioning here, or vibrating and not guilty on the charge of disorderly conduct. I said that would be an interesting issue if you were being charged with disorderly conduct, and I didn't do it. Yes, you did. But it is now a question on probable cause, which is the only issue before us. Did the deputy say what he said and believe it, and did he have any supporting for that?
Well, he had no support for it because...
And nothing else said the guy made a noise.
No, Mr. Yes. No, there was no disturbance. That's the problem here.
It depends on the definition of disturbance.
Here's what the judge says in the decision that is disorderly. I'll take your picture, and if you bother me anymore, I'll sue you, period. That is the basis of the disturbance.
There's some quiet time like that.
That's what the plaintiff says, and there are deputy witnesses that also say there was no boisterous conduct or loud conduct. There's other deputies say that both the officer
and everybody was hollering
were loud.
Yeah, okay.
And it's in dispute.
What did he say the officer said first when he approached him? The officer comes up to him and says what, according to your client?
According to my client, as he was approaching, his picture was taken. And according to my client, what was said is, you can't take my picture. My client said, well, what rule or law says I can't? And then there's even dispute as to what my client was doing. My client was distributing literature, and on one hand, Deputy Frankoriak says, yes, I saw them both distributing literature. And then when he gets to deposition, he said, no, I didn't see both of them. But then he says, I'd seen these people in the past doing this, so that's why I didn't ask for Mr. Brown's name. So there is disputes, but as best as I can tell, my client never said, I will not talk with you. I will not listen to you. That is completely disputed. And apparently, the trial court makes a lot out of, I'll sue you if you bother me, and I'm going to take your picture. That is the disorderly conduct. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stern, and thank you, Mr. Jorgensen.